Loving life in our city. We are Cambridge 105.
Ladies and gentlemen, come and dream with me.
Boy, all we gotta do is build an act, make you star. Dumbo the Great!
You're OG and I feel fine.
There, you slime-eating dogs, you scum-sucking pigs, you sons of a motherless goat.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
I've never been alone with a man before, even with my dress on. With my dress off, it's most unusual.
What is it?
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hey, what about Major Kong?
Hello, you're listening to...
...guy, but I've just experienced some very unreasonable things.
Hi, you're listening to Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Many thanks to Ian Dayborn for the very busy past couple of hours, but now it's time for Bums on Seats, the film show that will attempt to capture your heart with family dramas and comedies before bursting out of your chest. Not literally, of course. My name's Ashley Capaldi, and I'm joined today by reviewers Bridget Bradshaw.
Hello.
Rosie Applin.
Hello.
Dave Riley.
Hello.
And Alistair Ryder.
Hey there.
Mark's loitering in the green room somewhere. We try to lure him in. He's not having it. We've also got lovely guest producer Matt in today. He's covering for Toby, who's at the Cannes Film Festival, For His Sins. Thanks, Matt. Today's show starts in deep space with Ridley Scott's third visit to the franchise he started nearly 40 years ago with Alien Covenant. We take a trip to interwar Germany for relationship drama France, brave the flooded Somerset levels for farming family drama The Leveling, and we see Goldie Hawn's first on-screen role in over a decade as Amy Schumer's mother in Snatched. Plus, Mark, hiding in the green room, Mark Liversidge, talks to the Light Cinema in Cambridge about their new IMAX screen due to open in July. So, lots to come, but we start the show at the other end of the universe.
What happened here?
Okay, so Alien Covenant. This is the sequel to the 2012 film Prometheus, second installment in the Alien prequel series, sixth installment overall in the Alien film series, and the third installment to be directed by Ridley Scott. Alistair, did you get all that?
Well, that is a mouthful. And the reason I think Alien Covenant works better than Prometheus is because of recalibrated expectations. When Prometheus came out 5 years ago, I can't believe it's been that long already, but 5 years ago, it was really hyped and people were really disappointed because what they got was full of plot holes. It was just full of nonsense and this religious allegory that wasn't in the original Alien. Alien was a stripped-down B-movie that just happened to be really well-directed, and Sigourney Weaver had one of the best action heroines of all time. And coming to Alien Covenant after the disappointment of Prometheus, it actually works a lot better because as a Prometheus sequel, it expands upon that universe. And the ridiculousness of Prometheus, they've upped the ante this time. It's even sillier. This is a world where robots can grow hair and appear looking like Iggy Pop.
You're not sure about the hair. Like, you're hanging on that point.
And as a silly monster movie, it works very well. As an Alien prequel, however, that's where it starts to get a bit tricky. As this is, I think, the second out of four prequels that they've got.
It's the second out of three that are planned. There's a new trilogy, yeah, and we're in the middle of it.
Yeah, and this seems like it may be infringing upon sort of the enclosed world of Alien in a way that I'm not sure works too well.
Okay.
But it is bonkers, and it does push Prometheus forward. I'm just not sure it works as an Alien prequel.
Right, okay. So, yeah, a little bit of background. We have the starship is called the Covenant, so it's on a colonization mission to inhabit a new world. We've got a crew made up entirely of couples who are helping to settle the Earth. There's about, 2,500 settlers sleeping on the ship, but they're trying to get safely there. Catastrophic accident, as is the norm. So we've got Danny McBride, Billy Crudup, Catherine Watson. So they decide to head instead to a different planet that's much, much closer than the one they were supposed to be heading to. And they get a mysterious human voice distress call, and they go and try and figure out who or what it is. But yeah, not long. They end up the ones in need of distress. David, did this fit for you as an Alien franchise little slot as a whole?
It was a decent enough sequel to Prometheus. It was a bit better. I'm still not entirely sure why they're only letting the kind of silly people go into space and not someone smart.
Never anyone sensible.
Well, Sigourney Weaver in Alien, perfectly sensible.
One time.
Yeah.
Two times.
The first film. And, you know, send the Marines in the second one. In Prometheus,
The archaeologists did a great job. I'm backing those guys. Yeah. I think that was the fourth or something.
In Prometheus, it was sending a bunch of scientists who don't really know what science is, as far as I could tell. And in this one, it's sending intrepid explorers who are going to be killed by everything they explore.
Yeah.
It didn't work entirely well, but at the same time, I still found it better than Prometheus. There were bits where I was screaming at, once again, there was a massive plot hole, which I'm not going to mention in case anyone's not seen it yet. I was just like, but how can you not notice this? Ah!
Is it a spoiler, the plot hole?
It is a spoiler, so I'm not going to go in. I'm going to say that two of the best scenes are actually right at the beginning and end of the film and don't feature aliens, and they were kind of proper kind of cramped, fear
close
of enclosed
quarters.
Spaces, that one, close quarter horror moments, and I was just like, this is, yes.
Definitely.
And then sadly there was the rest of the film in between where I was just kind of giggling a bit. And
those 2 hours.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't notice, actually, Prometheus felt like a long slog. Mm. This did not when I was sitting through it. I actually enjoyed it a lot more. The pacing was a lot better.
I totally agree. Yeah, it was sort of a game of three thirds for me, really, in that there was a definite lull right there in the middle. But I thought there were more up moments than you're reckoning right at the end, right at the beginning.
And the body horror that they got it a bit wrong in Prometheus, I'd say. In this one, they kind of tapped back into the whole idea of alien body horror.
Okay, did that upset our Bridget a little bit? Is that your cup of tea? Body horror, Bridget? Are we into that kind of thing on a Saturday morning? Afternoon?
Well, the thing that horrified me is my body can't tolerate gluten. And the size of that wheat is in the trailer, so it's not a spoiler, but it's wheat the size of your fists.
Producer Toby nearly killed Bridget at a Christmas party. Spoiler alert, yeah. But yeah, apart from the terrifying wheat, what else? Did you get the sense of the danger, the intrepidness of the mission these guys were on?
Yeah, like the others, I enjoyed it more than Prometheus. It's much more of a fun run-around film, and there were still some visual, horrific moments that were quite new to me that I thought, ooh, that's like that guy out of Alien. Oh, hang on. I'm watching Alien. I think one of the things that made it work for me a bit more is Prometheus had the religious allegory, but this sort of slides it more towards the Frankenstein. I mean, it's obvious when you think of like Prometheus, the name, but there's all this stuff about layers and layers of fathers and sons and creators and gods, and they're all striving in their own way.
To be human, what is it that makes us human? That's the bit I love the most. So the religious allegory I thought fit really well, actually, but I didn't see Prometheus, so maybe that's why you hated it, Alistair. You hate a lot. But no, yeah, the references to art, poetry, what makes us human, is it our ability to create? It seemed really sort of careful and authentic. I really enjoyed that touch, because it could have just been a messy action film. So No, you're going to tell me it's still bad.
No, in what you're saying about Prometheus, without seeing it, you've actually perfectly described what Prometheus did wrong. It was very heavy-handed in addressing these sort of religious themes. Mm-hmm. And Alien Covenant is more careful. I mean, I do think that in some cases the literary elements are a bit on the nose, like Frankenstein is very obvious a reference. Yeah. And there's a moment where Michael Fassbender keeps quoting
Ozymandias by Byron Shelley.
And that just brings me back to Breaking Bad. Because whenever I hear that, I just always think that's used
in Breaking Bad. I've not seen Breaking Bad either, but I loved English literature at school, and that is one of my favourite poems. And it did seem to fit perfectly, and it was then that I understood the storyline that they were trying to lace underneath what I saw as an action film. This is way more action-y than sci-fi for me. So die-hard sci-fi fans, did the action take away from what should have been? It's a classic sci-fi franchise. Has it been chucked into action territory too much for you?
I think one of the things that is the problem with the action versus the sci-fi is in sci-fi, usually people are quite clever, but as we've ascertained, they did not bring their best people to these missions. They bring botanists.
Were you just swayed by James Franco at the beginning and you painted them all with the same brush, didn't you?
I was more swayed by when they were doing some biological sampling of this new planet they'd never been to before, and a guy says, I'm just off for a wee.
You go, treading everywhere, sitting down for cigarettes. They had no care for the flora around them, did they? No. I saw a really good interview with Ridley Scott, actually. He said he always thought of the first Alien film as a B-movie, so a little cast of seven, everyone dies. To him, it's like, oh, this will be a cool, fun B-movie I could just chuck together, and it turned out to be this massive blockbuster. Have we sort of caricatured the franchise now? Are we never going to get back what we had with Sigourney in the first one?
I think there are elements in this one that kind of harken back to it. You got a few, I mean, it's a bigger crew for a start. I think around 20 people. Most of them don't last that long, though. And you've got a few key kind of character actors in place. I actually want to single out Danny McBride and say it's always awesome when you get a comedian coming into a straight role. You think of Robin Williams doing a drama and anything like that. Danny McBride has now stepped up and done the same thing. And I was like, oh, I'm actually really enjoying. So he was still allowed to like be the sarcastic person, but he was also doing the I'm an action hero kind of, and it was really nice to see the change in the way he portrayed a character for once. And I was like, oh, good, yeah.
And part of his dramatic moments come from being worried about his wife, who is elsewhere at the time when he's worried about her, which we won't give away. But the whole crew are made up of these couples, which is, I liked the idea of it, but if we're going to go on and talk about the people's main complaint, which is that none of these characters make it past the 2D point, that's the only real pull we have to any of them. Fassbender not included in this because I think he's fantastic, all three of him. Again, kind of a spoiler. That's okay. We'll gloss over that. But no, yeah, the fact that these people are worried about their husbands and wives, that's the only real emotion they managed to show. Was everyone completely wooden, empty 2D for you? Was there anyone you liked?
Well, I don't think that's particularly a problem because, I mean, it's a staple for the genre. It's a monster movie. These are people who are supposed to make silly decisions. In a horror movie, that's what you expect. So I have no problems with that whatsoever, and it's perfectly more rational now that they're not scientists as they were in Prometheus. It makes a lot more sense for this one.
So this whole cast would have worked really well in a Scream prequel, wouldn't they?
Actually, yes.
They would have done really well. Not so much on the script front, is it? It's all just kind of the close, wide-eyed type. Yeah, so it has been slated for its predictability, of course. But as you were saying, surely multiple deaths, emergence of previously unknown fauna. It's true to the genre. People die on dangerous space missions. Why are we trying to make this more intellectual than it has ever been before?
Because Ridley Scott seems to be trying to, and so we go along with his attempts to make it more complex.
Yeah.
And I just can't quite make sense of it.
No, it's... Go.
I do think, though, that in terms of Ridley Scott's filmography, this is really interesting that he's put out a film so pessimistic right now, because his last film was The Martian, and that was an optimistic film about humanity's future in space, and this is like the pessimistic counterpoint, like, no, we're just not going to have the best time out there.
Yeah, and we saw in The Martian that you are able to develop a quite in-depth, intricate character in the middle of space, so I'm not sure why he didn't bother with this one. But yeah, there's more accusations of the story being disjointed, bits tacked in together. There was a sort of library of, not trailers, but these sort of mini films that have been drip fed out in the months leading up to the release, and they're showing various characters that weren't in the actual film, various bits of action that weren't in. So I'm sort of calling their bluff and saying I don't think they knew what they were doing when they started. Did you get that sense? Have they sort of just come in a roundabout way to a full feature-length film by chucking everything in and leaving it to the edit room?
It's possible, I suppose.
I mean,
I've seen one of the clips you're talking about, and it's like the crew's last dinner before they all go into hypersleep before they jet off on the Covenant. Yeah. And that actually was a scene that should have been left in the film because it gave you the characters. It kind of also gave you another alien-free danger moment in there because someone starts choking on their dinner, and then Fassbender steps up and goes, "Silly human," gives them a clip round the head, and they stop choking. It's fine. But it also gave you the crew in unity. They're all together. They're having their speech. James Franco actually gets a line. It's like, hey, James Franco's in this movie.
He's literally in it for 11 seconds right at the beginning. It was the weirdest thing ever. I was like, why are you here? I went back to Google it to make sure that I had seen his face and I wasn't making it up. But yeah, so one character that totally worked for me, or multiple characters, played by Michael Fassbender. So I have so much time for Fassbender. He was given the best character, wasn't he? He was the only guy that had any sort of arc, maybe because he got to split it up into more than one character. So, yeah, we'll give him that. But, you know, as the... What are they called? They're not robots. They're meant to look like humans. Synthetics. Yeah. Yeah, and he's beautifully synthetic. So there's... And they play with... They play with this idea of upgrades because he's not human, but then they give him these brilliant human elements of his madness, which reminds you a lot of Dr. Frankenstein. So that he jarred completely against everyone else for me, though, and that made everyone else seem so much worse at their job. But who's sharing the Fassbender love with me? Did he work for you, Alistair? Don't give me that look.
Oh, no, Fassbender's great in everything. I will happily watch Michael Fassbender in everything. As I say, the issues with his character aren't due to his performance. They're due to the script being a bit silly and suggesting that robots might be a bit cold on a spaceship and they need to wear a hoodie, or that robots can grow hair and appear looking like Iggy
Pop. Stop with the hair. The hair was fine. Bridget, are we into the hair? No.
No, we're into...
We're moving away from the hair.
We're into character development. And I think one of the ways in which Fassbender's two characters have so much more to them than the rest of the crew. So they've both, in a way, had generations either of time or of literal make a new model development going on. They've had a lot more time to think about the world or be...
That really fit well with me. Well, those are the characters through which we see the question, what is it that makes us human? And he really nicely, subtly played the difference between his earlier version and the upgrade. There's, annoyingly, I didn't see it coming because maybe I'm a bit stupid, but everyone hated the reveal at the end. There's a reveal where one character realizes something terrible and then we're left on the cliffhanger ready for the next film. You didn't get it either?
Oh, no, it's the most obvious twist in history.
Really?
Yeah, no, because an earlier scene is edited to abruptly end and everybody in the room can just clearly see. Yeah, you've edited that specifically.
Oh, so Dave, obvious.
That's also where there's a major plot hole, which I'm not going to discuss.
Oh, with the face?
Yeah, blah, blah, blah. You're not going to discuss it either.
Oh, that's not a spoiler, but you know what I mean by face. So when I went back to read up about it, yeah, that was annoying. And the Sigourney character in this, Sigourney would have never missed that massive. No. Yeah, but then again, she's Sigourney. So Alien Covenant opened last Friday. It's now showing at all three Cambridge cinemas and it's a 15. Okay, well, now we have director François Ozon. That's right, we'll go with that. Has a reputation for films which display both sharp wit and different perspectives on sexuality. He first made his name in 2002 with Huit Femmes, that's Eight Women, Don't See It. We reviewed it on the we reviewed it on our Christmas show and it ruined the season for me. And its follow-up film, Swimming Pool, and has since enjoyed a consistently successful career, both at home and abroad, with films such as Angel, Potiche, Dans la Maison, Je ne Jolie, and The New Girlfriend. His latest film, France, sees him on somewhat more subdued form. It tells a story of a young German woman, played by Paula Beer, who discovers a Frenchman visiting the grave of her fiancé. Okay, now her fiance was killed in the war, but we're not sure about the link between the two of them yet. So, and there's problems with having a Frenchman back in the town so soon after. This is where all the conflicts come from. Rosie, you wanted to like this.
I did. I thought it had all the hallmarks of the kind of film that I could get very emotional about. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I remained quite unmoved by it. And I think that was partly... It just felt... I really was expecting something a bit more from France. I mean, it is a beautiful story. And I think one of the things I really liked about it was the way the narrative kept changing and kind of unpacking. And I think what worked really well about it was that there were surprises in the narrative. So it didn't feel like a cliche, but it just... I don't know, it felt like it never really got off the ground for me in terms of that big emotional punch that maybe I was expecting when I kind of, you know, I saw the trailers and I had a sense of what the story was about. I thought, oh, this is really going to, you know, I'm going to be weeping on this one. But no, it just...
And you weep at anything as well, so...
That's, well, mostly true, but yeah. but no, not a tear was shed for me on France, I'm afraid. So I thought, I mean, one of the things that they do quite a lot in France is, Francois does, I should say, is he uses colour to sort of, I think, to suggest moments of kind of deep emotion or, you know, surfacing emotion. So the film is shot in black and white. And then when things are happening and changing, it will sort of suddenly blend into colour.
Where have we seen that before?
Well, I think The Wizard of Oz is the only example I can think
Schindler's
of.
Schindler's List.
Oh, yes.
Pleasantville.
Okay. Pleasantville!
Yeah, Pleasantville.
That was great, guys. Reese Witherspoon, check that one out.
That is a great film.
That is a great one.
But I feel like it just, for me, it didn't work as well as it could have done. It felt a little bit heavy-handed, to be honest, a little bit on the nose.
A
bit obvious. Yeah. And I'm sure there's people out there going, how can you think that? It was so beautiful.
Is Bridget one of those people? Are we in agreement? You had a better time of it, didn't you?
Yes, I loved it while I was watching it. I thought I was going to keep loving it now. I still do. But it didn't leave a lot with me.
No.
But all the stuff that was great was, I mean, it looked beautiful, it was exquisite, it was so well put together. It's all got all these reflections and levels and layers and repetitions. So we get a French person in Germany and a German person in France after the war, and all of the ways people react to you, and it switches back again. The colour, I like the colour as well. It wasn't like the vibrant technicolour of Wizard of Oz. It was much more subtle, quite an interesting...
Yeah, it's quite sort of muted.
Yes, but still sort of springtime, primrosy kind of feeling colours.
So it worked, it worked on more levels for you. We were lucky enough to be able to see a screener version of this film, and I actually had to watch it twice because I just wasn't held throughout the first viewing. I it's like when you read and you get to the end of a page and realise you've taken in nothing, so you start again. But it was the old, as I described it, eloquently to Rosie, that sadness. We go and sit in someone's house and then there's more sadness and we're inside another interior of another house with more sadness. And I didn't follow it whatsoever.
Sad piano, sad violin, sad
face. Yeah,
but their faces, they were so wounded. They were all wounded and haunted in different ways, and everyone had wounds that were visible from the war or not visible, because you don't talk about the way that your feelings are hurt.
So there saw the variations in the sadness. I saw monotone sadness.
It's like a box of interesting different dark chocolates, and they're all dark and they're all bitter, and they all taste interesting.
You need to come and watch stuff with me and explain this to me. No, yeah, I missed that. So greater eyes than me have been citing the Hitchcockian feel of it. That didn't hold any water with you, though, Rosie, did it?
Well, I had read a review, I think, or read something about this sort of Hitchcock feel to it. And I think the second half, you do get the sense, because so I think the first half and the second half are quite different. And it's as things start to be unpacked in the second half that I started to get more involved with the film and found it moved away a little bit from something that felt a tiny bit like something I'd seen before. It felt quite familiar at the beginning.
Yeah.
And as we follow Paula Beer's character on this quest, sort of uncover the truth of what's happening, it felt like it had a sense of Hitchcock, but it just didn't have that tension and that kind of, you know, it wasn't massively thrilling. It was more of kind of, you know... It was a journey of discovery for her character, I think. And I think she was one of the best things about the film. She can really emote with her, you know, her expressions were beautiful, and kind of she gives a very kind of contained performance, but, you know, that at times sort of slips over, and you do get a sense of that very deep emotional currents going underneath. But yeah, it still wasn't, it wasn't Hitchcock. It was, no. And I think the other issue I had with, it seemed like it was filmed, obviously it had been filmed in colour, but then the sort of way that that was translated to black and white, everything looked quite flat as well. And maybe that was intentional, but it just felt a bit sort of two-dimensional in that respect. Yeah. And I guess that maybe that was the idea, so there was the contrast with the colour bits, but
yeah, it lacked depth in lots of places for me. What's that black and white film that won the Oscar for Best Picture with the dog?
The Artist.
It reminded me of the films they're pretending to make in The Artist.
Yeah.
That's about
yeah.
how invested I was in it. And there were no... Were there any dogs in this? I would have noticed.
I think, yeah, we'd remember, I think.
I would have remembered that. But no, can you persuade anyone to see it, Bridget? One more push, go on. Lure them into the picture house.
My eyes were riveted throughout. It's just this search people have for healing, and there's a lot of the ways people are upset, and you might tell a kind lie to help heal someone. It's, okay. it's full of that sort of interesting texture.
So we need to look out for the little nuances in the
go and feel the pain of post-war.
Feel the pain, okay.
French and German people.
Take that with you guys.
Go to a better
place.
Don't
listen to me and Rosie. Listen to
and
you.
And then at the end go, no, it's all, yeah.
Don't tell them about the end.
I'm not
Bums
gonna,
and
no.
Seats 101. But anyway, France opened last week. There are still some showings at the Arts Picture House. You can also rent it online via the Curzon Home Cinema platform. And it is a certificate 12A. OK, now, cinema has long sought to battle the likes of home video, as I've just mentioned, upstarts, and create a big cinema experience. And with a Netflix logo being booed at Cannes this week, tensions are still clearly running high in the industry. One of the most successful innovations has been the IMAX cinema experience, which attempts to bring the best possible sound, comfortable seats, and a considerably larger, squarer viewing area. While the dedicated IMAX film cameras were initially cumbersome to work with, they are being increasingly used for summer blockbusters. All of Christopher Nolan's new film Dunkirk was shot especially for the format. And until now, the closest cinemas for us in the region have been in Stevenage and Ipswich, but that's all about to change. The Light is continuing a £2 million redevelopment programme, which will not only see further changes to the other screens, but a complete overhaul of the largest screen as it becomes Cambridge's first ever IMAX. It's on course to be open in July, just in time to show Dunkirk, and Mark Liversidge spoke to General Manager John Corbett to ask him about the installation process and what it will mean for customers.
Cinema as a company, we sort of decided, in addition to the overhaul of the service, there needed to be an overhaul of the actual cinema itself. And that's when we contacted IMAX to discuss potentially putting the first IMAX screen into Cambridge. IMAX is something that we've always wanted to do. We've always had a lot of interest in it. You know, as a company, The Light, we pride ourselves on being forward-thinking. We've worked with IMAX now for the past few months, and who are, by the way, are a fantastic company to work with. Their specification is what cinema is about. You know, it's image maximum. I think the acronym sells it perfectly and describes it perfectly.
What does that involve in terms of screen then? Presumably it's a brand new screen that has to be brought in?
Absolutely, brand new screen. Now, the interesting thing about IMAX is that whereas all our other screens have one projector, IMAX is actually two projectors with two images overlapping each other, almost similar to what 3D is, but far more intricate, and it creates an absolute crystal clear picture.
Sometimes there's a little bit of snobbishness with the sort of IMAX aficionados about how big is.
There's a lot of misinformation
about IMAX, I think, and everybody goes back to the 70mm and, you know, as opposed to 35mm. In actual fact, this is misunderstanding, a very, very, very descriptive misunderstanding, in the sense that 70mm is prior to the age of digital technology. And since digital technology has come into play, nearly all IMAX screens are exactly what we're going to get. I think currently in the UK there's only two 70mm screens in action still. So it's just the natural progression from you know, 70mm to digital projection and laser-like technology, which is what our IMAX will be, and what I think, you know, the majority, probably over 90% of all the other IMAX theatres in the UK actually are.
I guess there's quite a lot of challenges involved in actually coming into a building like this where it was previously a cinema owned by someone else, and I think to come in and do that kind of refurbishment, from the sounds of it, it's been a fairly challenging process.
You know, with the additional refurbishment of the other screens, including Screen 9, where the IMAX will be, we have decided to increase the size of the seat, increase the legroom affiliated with that seat. So although the Screen 9 was 341 seats, it will go down to approximately 190 seats now. So we did lose some of that capacity, but we've made up for it with ultimate luxury, I think. Regarding the screen, yes, it's a big screen. it's actually bigger than I ever thought it was going to be. It's fully immersible. It's absolutely incredible. We've actually had to raise the ceiling and lower the floor in order to fit the screen in. And obviously, it's curved by nature, as IMAX is. It should bring the Dunkirk, the Christopher Nolan film we're open to, it should really, really bring it to life. It's going to be an incredible.
The call went out. We have to go to Dunkirk. Ready on the stern line.
What are you doing? You know where we're going.
Into war, George.
I'll be useful, sir.
One of ours. He's on me.
I'm on him.
Oh yeah, certainly one thing I've noticed when I've been into some of the other IMAX screens in the country is, you mentioned the sound as well. When you walk in, there's this almost incredible bass rumble that you almost feel the sound coming from the screen. And does the sound involve doing anything different with the speakers? Is it an existing setup or is that brand new to the IMAX?
All brand new. Absolutely all brand new. And easily comparable to some of these the new audio technology coming out of Dolby Atmos and things like that.
There's a gradual library of IMAX films being built up now. So as well as the latest releases, will you have the opportunity to go back and show some of those IMAX classics like the Dark Knights and things like that?
Absolutely. I think probably from the amount that I've mentioned Christopher Nolan, I'm a big fan of his. And we specifically tailored around opening IMAX for Dunkirk because, you know, Christopher Nolan films are solely in IMAX, and for that reason... It was a no-brainer to me. I can't guarantee this, but we're aiming for this. We are looking at potentially doing a marathon of Christopher Nolan films in and around the first week, potentially for some of our Infinity guests. And we like to, like I mentioned, we are looking at the Interstellar, Inception, the Dark Knight trilogy, and other films similar to that. The best film I've ever seen in IMAX, hands down, no question, is Interstellar. I mean, it blew my mind, and that was the defining film that made me decide that it's IMAX or bust. You know, it was that good.
Yeah. You're the best pilot we ever had.
Get out there and save the world.
Everybody ready to say goodbye to our solar system?
To our galaxy.
Here we go.
We're here.
Want to get down fast, don't we?
Actually, we want to get there in one piece.
Hang on.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Okay, many thanks to John Corbett for the interview, and special thanks to Bridget, sat in front of me, for editing it all together. Since the interview was recorded, the Lights have confirmed that the IMAX will carry a £5 add-on per show for Infinity card holders, but that the overall Infinity price will be frozen so that the other upgrades to the cinema won't be passed on to customers.
Every Saturday afternoon, Cambridge 105 goes out and about at some of the events that make up the summer in the city. This week, Liz Barker's on a bat safari. Rosina Piovani reports from the Cambridge Botanic Gardens Festival of Plants. Linda Ness is at the Cambridge Night Market. Neil Whiteside and Lee Chambers visit Grafham Water. And Mark Liversidge is at the Art Hound Gallery at Burwash Manor. Join Julian Clover this weekend from 3 for Summer Saturday.
And Summer Saturday returns between 3 and 5pm today, hosted by Julian Clover. But before that, and following straight in after we wrap up at 1pm, is The Science Show. That's followed at 2pm by this month's Radio Dante, the magazine programme for the Italian/Cambridge listener. Then it's Summer Saturday for a couple of hours, followed by 105 This Week, as Mark Liversidge picks through the best of this week's reports and interviews. But meanwhile, here at Bums on Seats, we feel it's also worth drawing your attention to a number of film events taking place over the Bank Holiday Monday weekend, which is the 29th of May, the Monday. At the Arts Picture House, there's the latest in the Korean Film Festival Taster Screenings series with Queen of Walking. We have the first ever film by acclaimed director Abbas Kiarostami, sounds right, The Traveller, and a showing of the documentary It Was 50 Years Ago Today about the legendary Beatles album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. That screening is followed by a Q&A, and there's another Q&A following the screening of Letters from Baghdad over at Saffron Screen the same evening. That's out in Saffron Walden, FYI. But before today's show is over, we'll be reviewing Snatched, the mother-daughter comedy with Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn. David is looking forward to that one. But before that, we've a very different kind of family reunion.
You came!
Stay for the funeral.
Of course. What's this?
Home.
Since when?
Since the house flooded. Our very own refugee camp.
He shot himself. What happened at the party, James?
Out of his mind. Then I heard a bang. It was just a bloody stupid accident.
You don't accidentally put a gun in your mouth.
He didn't mean to shoot himself. I've just given him the farm, for God's sake.
So you gave the farm to Harry?
You left.
You told me to get the hell out of here.
You're so stupid.
Stop calling me stupid. I'm not bloody stupid.
If there's anything else I can do.
Can you make it my dad instead of my brother? I don't want this to be your fault! Not again.
Get her.
It's been a strong year for films from first-time directors. There's been The Fitz from Anna Rose Holmer. That was ace. Check that out the first instance you get. We also had Lady Macbeth from William Oldroyd. And now there's The Leveling from writer-director Hope Dixon Leach. Set in a deep corner of rural Somerset, The Leveling stars Ellie Kendrick as Clover, a farmer's daughter painfully estranged from her family. Her return home to mourn the suicide of her younger brother opens old wounds with her father, played by David Troughton, still bewildered and bruised by his daughter's decision to abandon the struggling farm for a life elsewhere. As the family funeral nears, a household already wound tight threatens to disintegrate. Now, there's so much to talk about in this film. It's 123 minutes long, and I think it was definitely the most impactful for all of us this week who saw it. So to get technical, Rosie, the sound you mentioned initially, that was one of the things that really grabbed you to start with.
It did, yeah. I mean, it's an incredibly assured debut film, and there was so many things I could say about it, but one of the things I really took from it was how very kind of powerful the difference between the silences and the sound are in the film. So there is, I mean, the dialogue is always very, you know, meaningful, and it works very well, but there's so much going on in the soundtrack. So just for example, for a moment, she's walking the main character Clover, played by Ellie Kendrick, she walks up to this locked barn, and just the sound of her feet crunching on the gravel, just the tension that builds, and everything about it is just very painfully real. And I think the sound really, really contributed to that. So, you know, they're digging in the field, and just the sound of the spades kind of scratching into the mud. It was just really powerful.
And I should say, it wasn't 123 minutes, it's an hour and 23 minutes. It runs at 83 minutes long. So the feat that this first-time director has completed on no money. She made this for £1 million, I think. That was it. So it's stark and it's bare, but it was still so impactful, wasn't it, Bridget? What was your takeaway? Did this one stick with you better than France did?
Oh, yes. I had a lot to like about the levelling. With the budget, a lot of it is just set on one farm.
Yeah.
And that works pretty well. You've got a lot of locations there, and they were used so well. There's a really good sense of place. I felt like I had visited that farm.
I felt like I'd lived there for
a long time.
Yeah.
And the interactions on the face of it, they're very plain talking folk. I was talking earlier about what sort of metaphor would I use for this film, and they would go, well, you don't need a metaphor, because what you see is what we get, we're just here. And of course, underneath the I will just pick up whatever anorak is lying around because I need to go out in the rain to milk the cows,
yeah,
is a whole generation of horrible family interaction and upset about mother dying and how that gets handled, and boarding school, and they are not able to unpick what is going on, and it's really difficult to be in that position where you're still judged as if you were a child, whereas now you're in your mid-20s and you're nearly a fully qualified vet. And in a way it goes along with the farming metaphor, because nothing can grow. The people can't grow. I mean, the farm obviously can't grow because there's been a tragic flood, and they're still trying to reclaim the land for the field.
And they're all busting out of this tiny caravan they've moved into because the house has been flooded as well. So there's this fully grown woman and her cantankerous, grieving father sort of wedged into this tiny caravan. It's back to that claustrophobia thing, isn't it? So it's the stark images, that crunchy, bleak sound. And then we're just cramped in this, it's hellish that they're living situation at the moment. Alistair, what are you in agreeance, dare I ask? Probably not.
No, I am in agreeance. It's the thing, it's really subtle in how it manages to make an emotional impact. There are no big emotional moments. Even the outbursts of rage feel sort of embedded in what the characters aren't saying.
Aren't they?
Nobody feels, even in the moments when they are expressing the emotions, it never feels like they're fully laying bare what's on their mind. And I also think that the cinematography in this, I mean, we're talking about France being confused about the cinematography and how it bleeds into colour and not being sure what that means. In the levelling, everything, even the colours, are all tinged with this sort of grey, and it feels like a sort of visual manifestation of their bleak emotional state. The characters, the father and daughter, feel completely on the different pages to each other, and yet their shared grief is only manifesting itself in the sort of bleak surroundings that they're both stuck in.
Yeah, that the dad was such a quietly just tragic character for me, because I didn't like him for maybe 90% of this film, and then you finally clicks for you. It's, I'm sure there are many, many moments throughout where the director's trying to make that happen for you, but it was maybe the penultimate one for me, and I just realised, okay, I have this guy completely wrong. Bridget, you said it's been on the film festival circuit for a while now. It's only just come to the picture house for us.
It's great that it's getting a release now. And it was on at Underwire. I think they show 4 feature films, so it's good to be one of the ones picked for that, and had a lot of good reviews.
It was in one of the smaller picture house screens, but it was that gorgeous sunny Saturday when I was there, and it was a full house, so people are interested, their interest is piqued by it, and everyone seemed to enjoy it very much. The thing I liked most, so you were just saying you're not sure why it is that you're feeling the way you do about the characters, and what is it that's slightly off about them, and I had to really think. My main takeaway is the way the main characters are shot. There's only maybe 4 people in this film, and it's the daughter and the dad you see for 80% of the time, and they're shot like horror characters. It reminded me of seeing Michael Myers in the middle of the screen, sort of a full body shot taken from sort of slightly below, and that their faces and their bodies just fill the screen. They look menacing, these people. Mm. And I'm really not sure why that was, but I was scared of them as well as scared for them. It was just such an all-round uncomfortable experience, but in a really good way.
Yeah, I think because there's so much sort of emotions going on under the surface, and there's so much that they're not saying to each other, that really builds up the dramatic tension. So they are actually quite alarmed by each other. When they kind of come across each other, there is that sense of shock, and you know, because there's so much that's not being dealt with, and
it's tragically all the way through. Yeah,
and there are some other elements, images that could be horrific in a different film. Mm. Bones, carcasses. Mm. They seem ghastly, and then either you realise it's part of a hog roast dinner, or it's part of the normal things that go on in the farmyard. So these things that might normally disgust you or horrify you,
they're just surrounded by death, aren't they, as well? But and that's something you mentioned, Rosie. You liked how nature was represented in it and how it worked sort of alongside the story and within the film.
Yeah, it was almost felt like nature, or the kind of the environment they're inhabiting, was a character of its own. And you know, that was kind of borne out as well in they would have these occasional moments where you'd see a hare swimming in the river, or you know, the dog has a sort of a very strong place in the main character's heart. And
that's what France was missing.
It was.
No dogs.
but all of that kind of natural imagery, and it really felt that it was kind of going back to the very kind of primal human, I don't know, it reminded me a bit of, we recently reviewed Raw, and it reminded me of that tonally, just those kind of, those images of,
another
of
first-time
animalistic
director as well.
Scenes. Yeah, absolutely. And those kind of very real, sort of quite, yeah, almost quite visceral.
Yeah, it's definitely one to watch. Definitely, just over an hour, and so much is packed in. Do we have any final comments we want to make? Because we are hurtling towards the end of the show, and sadly, we have to stop and talk about Snatched. So, anything else on the Leveling Guys before I pull you away out?
I'll just say that this is further proof that British cinema has a new generation of fantastic directors coming through. I mean, with Lady Macbeth just a couple of weeks ago, and now this. I mean, there were really bold pictures that are taking, you know, sort of standard British cinema. Like, this is a social realist film, but it's not told in the same way a standard social realist narrative would be told. It feels fresh, and the characters are believable, and that's why it just packs the emotional punch that it does.
It's a definite one to not miss, to use a terrible cinematic cliche. Okay, The Leveling opened last week. It still has some screenings at the Arts Picture House. You can also rent it via the BFI Player on YouTube and via Google Play, as well as other online services. But get down to the Picture House, see it on a big screen. You won't regret it. It's also a Certificate 15. Okay, our last film of the show takes us to Ecuador, the holiday destination for Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn in Snatched. Amy Schumer plays Emily Middleton, a 30-something who believes her life is settled until she's unceremoniously dumped by her musician boyfriend. Left with a non-refundable paradise holiday already booked, Emily decides to take her mother Linda, played by Goldie Hawn, a once adventurous spirit now too cautious to leave the States. But in an effort to bring her mother into the fun, the two find themselves abducted and at the mercy of kidnappers.
I met a man.
Well, drinking with a man in a foreign country, it's a smart, responsible thing to do.
We need an amazing adventure.
Where the hell are we?
The scenic group.
Stop the...
Listen, I need your help. Mom and I got kidnapped.
State Department.
My mom and sister. They've been taken. I imagine you have a commando squad. 4 underground criminals who were tried for a crime they didn't commit.
Sounds like the A-team.
It is the A-team. Do you have an A-team?
Why did I ever let you talk me into this?
I should have just listened to you. I love you.
This is great, but we really gotta get out of here, you know?
Yeah, we should get out of here. Okay.
Mom, we have to fight, Mom.
We've got this.
Mom, that was awesome.
You messed with the wrong bitches.
Yeah. Go. I'm gonna count down. I'm gonna do it.
Please.
100. 99.
Right, David, you've got nothing useful to say, so I'll just go ahead and say what I have to say. I love Goldie Hawn so much. She is one of my comedic heroines. She's featuring in my upcoming Big Birthday. Anyone who's coming along, we're going to watch Death Becomes Her. She's been away for a while. She was a comedic genius in her day. This is her much, much, much anticipated big comeback. What the hell, Dave? What the hell?
Yeah, it just went wrong, didn't it, really?
It was all wrong.
it's tricky. I mean, it was quite a simple premise. They go on holiday, they get kidnapped, yeah. Hijinks ensue. They're really dull hijinks, though.
You took one for the team. You're the only reviewer that saw this apart from me this week. So what would you rather have been doing? Shall we list those activities?
Well, I took time out from work to go and see it. I'd rather have stayed at work. It's not the worst film I've seen this week. I also went to see King Arthur, Cockney edition, and that was...
Oh, see, they're on a par for me.
Oh, no, King Arthur was just... It's like it took all the worst part of all the Warner Brothers superhero movies and put it into this medieval times movie without the medieval times in.
It was medieval times.
Was there actually a sword fight at any point?
At the beginning, there was a little bit. Yeah. They all seem to be about 5 feet away from each other during said sword fight, but you're supposed to be talking about Snatch. You're not getting out of it.
Okay. Yeah, sorry. Well, okay. I've gone to the good things about Snatch. There were a couple of them. Wanda Sykes and Joan Cusack. As two, they're another, I don't know if they're meant to be a couple or not, but they're also on holiday.
Are, yeah.
And Wanda Sykes is this amazing paranoid holiday goer. And whenever you see them all kitted out with, like, you know, be aware t-shirts, and Joan Cusack is an ex-special ops who's cut out her own tongue so she can't divulge secrets.
Yeah.
Which does have one of the related jokes in the movie. So I'll spoil it now for it. No.
Are we talking about the thing out of
the something when Amy Schumer just comments on it. Yeah
right.
That bit I actually laughed at.
How can we go wrong with Joan Cusack and Goldie Hawn in the same place at the same time? I don't get it. How can these women get it so wrong when they're sent these scripts and take the job? I don't get
Joan
it.
Joan Cusack wasn't allowed to say anything, and I find, you know...
She was still one of the best in it.
Yeah. She's a very good visual comedian, but she's just a very good comedian, hands down. Let her do stuff.
To try and put this in perspective, we just reviewed The Leveling, which is the best thing most of us have seen in a little while. That cost £1 million to make. This cost $42 million to make. Like,
how?
What the hell? I know. So she pays for her own plastic surgery, Rosie, I'm sure of it. But there is the one good thing, and I'm sure that's where all the money went. We have some great classic action shots here, and it's really nice to see a pretty much all female cast looking bad AS.
Yeah,
walking away from an explosion.
And talk about Oscar Haneda as the drug lord, because he's got it's like he's been given the biggest slice of ham ever to chew on, and he does that wonderfully. There's a, you know, people keep accidentally dying as well as people being murdered, and his reaction to one of them, the screaming, it reminded me of bad acting by Joey in Friends.
Okay.
It was beautiful, a beautiful moment. And also, what's his name? Christopher Maloney pops up. People know him from Law and Order. He's got one of the most self-deprecating roles, I think, in the entire...
He's the explorer dude,
and then he's given all these throwaway lines, which could have been funny, weren't funny, but then he gets the best death scene in the
none of it was funny. None of it was funny, and I don't get it, because I really liked Trainwreck, actually. That was close to the bone. There was toilet humour in that, and it really worked. I loved that.
It just felt disjointed in this one.
It was, yeah.
There was the opening scene where she does get dumped, the interplay mm-hmm. between Schumer and I think it's Randall Park in that scene. That was actually probably the funniest scene of the film in the first 5 minutes. And then there's another hour and 25 that you made me go and sit through.
We'll make Toby take the blame for that because he's in a different country. A better use of our time would be to read the outro, I think, and listen to some more news. That would probably be more entertaining.
It could be more entertaining for everyone else.
Yeah. Well, Snatched and opened... And sadly, on May the 19th, and is screening at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. They will be empty. It is certificate 15. Right, that's all we have time for, folks, for this show. Sorry to end on that bummer. If you missed anything, the last hour will be repeated this coming Monday at 11 p.m, while our now traditional podcast will pop up on Tuesday. Remember that you can find all our podcasts both on iTunes, just search for Bums on Seats, and our page on the Cambridge 105 website, which is www.cambridge105.co.uk. Normally, we would be back in a couple of weeks, but instead we'll be taking a break as Cambridge 105 broadcasts live from the Strawberry Fair. So instead, we will return to onto the airways on Saturday the 17th of June. Between now and then, the summer blockbuster season sees the first proper female superhero movie of the modern era with Wonder Woman and Tom Cruise battling the Mummy, as well as Oscar-nominated animations The Red Turtle and My Life as a Courgette. Okay. And new films from acclaimed directors such as Kate Shortland and, why do you do this to me, Hirokazu Koreeda. If you have strong feelings as to what you'd like us to review, let us know by searching for Bums on Seats on Facebook or Twitter and leave us a message. Please stay tuned for the science show, but from everybody here at Bums on Seats, goodbye.
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 They're waving.